Welcome to another edition of the Sea Control Podcast, your moment of PowerPoint rehab from the Center for International Maritime Security. So, after a long period of baby leave, your semi-helpful host, President of SimSec, Matthew Hipple, does his glorious return, and this week we are joined for discussion on cyber, some of the commands involved on the Navy side, Captain Sean Heritage, the Commanding Officer of Navy Cyber Defense Operations Command, but more importantly, a very close friend of organizations like Athena and SimSec and USNI in the realm of innovation. So a very smart guy, very devoted naval officer, and a very creative mind. So, of course, these being far more important to the discussion necessarily than his very relevant position. But before we jump into that conversation, we'll have a quick word from my wife.
SimSec brings you the best content on maritime security, technology, history, and international affairs. And, like the United States, SimSec is, and always will be, free. Sign up to become a member today by visiting www.cimsec.org/about/membership, which gets you daily emails of our articles and a WordPress account that sends your own writings directly to our editorial staff. However, admin, special projects, software, events, and prizes do cost money. There's a new option to make a voluntary monthly donation at the bottom of every SimSec article. No matter how you choose to support us, those who volunteer for leadership, our amazing content producers, our readers, our listeners, our conference planners and attendees, and our financial benefactors, we are incredibly grateful. Remember, Sea Control is more than just a podcast, and SimSec is more than just a website. We are a vibrant community built on a passion for discovery and discussion. Sign up, write, donate, comment, or even leave 5 stars on our iTunes page. Join us today.
And we're back. We are here with Captain Sean Heritage, Commanding Officer of Navy Cyber Defense Operations Command. And sir, the way we like to do it here is that instead of me giving an introduction to our guests, I give them the opportunity to tell the audience who they are in their own words, because of course it is your life and you are far more familiar with it than everyone else. So let me cede the floor to you and tell our audience who is Captain Sean Heritage and kind of why is he involved in cyber? Where did he come from?
All right, Matthew. Well, first and foremost, I am a husband of 20 years to my beautiful bride, Marianne. I'm also a father of 12 years to my son, Barrett. And then thirdly, I'm a leader within the naval profession where I've been serving for the last 23 years. And I've had the pleasure of being the commanding officer of NCDOC, Navy Cyber Defense Operations Command, and commander Task Force 1020, the distributed DCO, Defensive Cyberspace Operations Task Force, for the last 165 days. And my hope is, you know, the way I answered your question, the way I introduced myself, is all about time. Time is extremely important to me personally and professionally, and priorities. Priorities are also extremely important to all of us as leaders and human beings, and my priorities are, in fact, in that order: husband, father, leader, naval officer, and then CO of NCDOC. How I got involved into the cyber world, as with many things in my life, was not necessarily my plan A. It's a succession of plan Bs that oftentimes, and in my opinion, all the time for me, have been better than the original plans. So I entered the naval service to be an airline pilot. And I had zero time in the cockpit, but I am an information warfare officer, and it was good fortune for me. But it was definitely not the reason I joined the Navy. It was, in my opinion, far better than the reason I joined the Navy.
Wow. So we'll get back to kind of that career progression and all the different things that you've seen and done. But for now, let's take a look kind of where you are. So Navy Cyber Defense Operations Command. So we've all seen Live Free, Die Hard with Bruce Willis. So we all understand how Cyborg works, right? There's a charismatic dude in a trailer somewhere hacksawing things, and then, I don't know, a gas plant somewhere explodes. But maybe give us a little bit of the ground truth that doesn't involve a bunch of teenagers running around with, like, wrist keyboards. So what is it that Navy Cyber Defense Operations Command actually does? Like, how does that defense part work?
All right. Well, our mission at Navy Cyber Defense Operations Command is not just to provide network defense. We feel our role in the Navy is to enable global power projection as well as sustain combat operations at sea when necessary through proactive network defense. So that is our role as a proud member or a team within the larger naval enterprise. So we are the Navy's leader, if you will, when it comes to defensive cyberspace operations. The name of our command is purposeful. We are cyber defense. We are defensive cyberspace operations. We do not dabble in anything other than that. So we are also the task force. 10th Fleet has been very deliberate since its inception of leveraging the task force, the power of the task force. And as Task Force 1020, we partner with our distributed teammates across 10th Fleet. So though we call Suffolk, Virginia our home, we are really leading with a distributed team across the globe that includes Navy Information Operations Commands, so NIOCs, in Hawaii, Texas, Georgia, and Maryland, as well as NAVCOM Telstays, so telecommunication stations throughout the globe. Recently, we've also taken on the mission of afloat defensive cyberspace operations, which enables us to place an extension of our team in the form of a 2 to 3, at this point, member augmentation team in every strike group and amphibious readiness group. So, you know, we're very proud of the fact that we have one building with one mission that encapsulates our entire command. But as we leverage the task force, we are really distributed across the globe.
So what is a cyber defense operation look like? You know, we have a lot of different visions kind of in the media as to how this works. And of course, I understand, and our audience understands, that due to your position and the nature of cyber operations, that your answers may not be as specific as folks would want. But you know, this is we're practical folks. We understand that there's operational security involved in a lot of these answers. But you know, you say you've got afloat defensive operations. You've got a lot of shoreside cyber defense that's necessary. I mean, the Navy is a vast, vast, vast organization, and every single individual in it, somewhere at some point, uses networked systems. And you guys are the cyber defense guys. So how does your small institution manage the defense of such a vast organization?
Well, as you would imagine, and as I alluded to earlier, partnerships are critical to successful defensive cyberspace operations. So these partnerships are with the intelligence community across the various services. And our specific contribution at this stage of the game is leveraging our unique sensor grid to identify what is happening on our network as best as we can, which is increasingly challenged because our network, as you point out, is not bounded as well as we might like, and our sensor grid is not necessarily as robust or numerous as we might like. So it's all about accepting risk where we can and should, because we cannot do everything.
So essentially, and correct me if I'm wrong here, Cyber Defense Operations Command has unspecified ability to detect what's going on across whatever parts of the network are connected. And of course, being in the Navy, we realize that pieces of the network may detach, like, let's say, a strike group, and they may not be as easy to monitor when they are underway. That is monitored through a system by your personnel at NCDOC. So it's essentially kind of a little bit like a NORAD for the internet, spelled with a Z.
I think for the sake of this conversation, that is an accurate description of what it is we do and how we do it. So yes, it got to define the network. So we're talking about CIPRNet and NIPRNet, so our unclassified and GenCERN networks. So we don't monitor everything. We monitor what we can as best we can. That includes our IT21, our NMCI networks, as well as other accepted networks that fall underneath the Navy's scope of responsibility. And all of this is done on behalf of Fleet Cybercom or 10th Fleet. So we recognize we don't do anything on our own. We're the representatives of 10th Fleet that lead the DCO mission area.
So we're discussing this network, and I'm putting it in quotes here, and I'm letting you know because, you know, no one can see it. This is a podcast. But that's such a broad – we talked about how broad the network is in the Navy itself, but also when it comes to how you define that network – it is also equally diverse. So there's everything from my Navy email to going on websites like Imgur or going on to Gmail and using that. So we kind of get a sense of the geographic scope that Cyber Defense Operations Command covers. But what is that network itself that you're defending? What does that look like? Or at least maybe as with a professional like you in the cyber realm, how would you describe what it looks like, you know, for those who are still discussing things in terms of dump trucks versus tubes, if anyone remembers that video from a while back?
So when it comes to describing the network on our end, we're talking about IT20, talking about NMCI, OneNet, and other what we call accepted networks, where we do in fact have some sensors out there so that we can monitor what is and is not happening. Where we run into a lot of trouble is, and one of our biggest challenges right now is a cultural challenge. And that is the fact that, you know, think about NMCI at your workplace and how open it is for us to do things that we deserve the right to do on our networks, mainly check our Gmail, our webmail, whatever your
or even need to do, you know, like going on to the news.
Correct. So I think that the Navy, by and large, has been very open to the quality of life uses of our network, as well as some of the things that on the surface may not seem mission related, but really are. So we've accepted a lot of risk with that approach. But I don't think that we have a good understanding for how much risk we've actually accepted. So, for example, if I'm on my NMCI, and we at NCDOC are not on NMCI, by the way, we're on our own separate enclave that is more locked down because we truly treat our network or our enclave as a weapon system. And I don't think if you were really going to treat your network as a weapon system that you would accept the level of risk that we have. So if you log into Gmail and you are a victim of a spear phishing campaign and you open up the attachment, you in essence have compromised our network. That is not something that we would notice. That is not something that our sensors are equipped to sense. So when we think about what it is we should be opening up to our network, we really have to think about what our level of accepted risk should be. So right now, we at NCDOC are doing a lot of research on how we can best enable ourselves locally, as well as our extended teammates, with the opportunity to access things that enable us to do a better job without giving us reason to request hard drives be shipped to Suffolk, Virginia, so that we could do some malware analysis on it, because it happens a lot more than you might expect.
All right, so we've given sort of a broad brush strokes of it is that Navy Cyber Defense Operations Command does, but to sort of open up that scope to a question I'm sure some people are asking. So Navy Cyber Defense Operations Command has a very broad mandate. You know, your mission is very specific, but it is a huge mission. But you are underneath Cybercom and 10th Fleet. I'm sure a number of people are listening and say, well, Cyber Defense Operations Command sounds a lot like what I'd imagine CyberCom for the Navy is like. Who's this 10th Fleet dude and why does he exist? What are those relationships like, and what are the mandates of the folks that you find yourself under the command of?
Well, I am reminded every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday when we have our commander's update brief with the commander of Fleet CyberCom of how extensive her and the staff's portfolio responsibilities really is. That they are called Fleet Cyber Command, but their scope of responsibility is much bigger than defensive cyberspace operations. I don't know off the top of my head how many commands or report to them. I can tell you that there are 9 task forces that report to them, and each task force is very different. So we are but a piece of her portfolio. I think a growingly more important piece, and we do get a lot of her personal attention as well as the staff's. But we recognize that it is our responsibility to lead on her behalf, and that there is a lot more than DCO or defensive cyberspace operations that she is concerned about.
Is it an unfair prod to that question to ask what some of those other items of the portfolio may be?
No, I mean we have.
I'm trying to avoid accidentally asking a explicitly inappropriate question about Navy cyber capability. So I do excuse me if this question sounds like a really extra pulled punch.
No. I mean, I wouldn't talk about capabilities, but each task force is very different. All are focused on the fleet or the other fleet in different ways. Some are geographically focused. Our partners within the building over in Suffolk, Virginia, CTF 1010, which is Naval Network Warfare Command, and then their responsibility is to operate the network, not to defend it. And that is why we are co-located with them. They operate as 1010. We defend as 1020. But we have CTF 1030, NIAC Norfolk, and subordinate commands that are focused on getting the fleet ready, as well as some other things, but getting the fleet ready to leverage information operations capabilities across the task force. Then we have the geographically focused task force that are also underneath 10th Fleet. And then we have some other special capabilities that are leveraging the larger intel community, as well as some capability development that not only helps in the joint world, but also deliver some unique capability in the future, or will in the future, for Navy-specific operations.
So pulling back even further, you were Director of Exercises at CyberCom during your career. How do you think that has informed you practically as the commanding officer of Navy Cyber Defense Operations Command? Because I'm imagining that you used to be the guy that would, in a good and red team way, poke NCDOC in the eye. So how do you think that those two things have worked together to kind of make you a better commander of NCDOC?
Well, first, to clarify, when I worked at U.S. Cyber Command in the J7, we did not get involved in the service-level business. Each service staff has their own responsibilities to do that. Our focus was, and I think in large part continues to be, that of the Cyber Mission Force. So building the Cyber Mission Force that U.S. CyberCom is leveraging in partnership with each of the services. So we were focused on making sure that the cyber protection teams or the cyber support teams, cyber mission teams, were ready for operational employment. We were also, and continue to be, involved with Tier 1 exercises at other COCOMs. And that, to me, has been the largest lesson that I learned in that job, was what an opportunity it is to educate others through exercises. At the same time, what a frustration it can be when you are openly invited to sprinkle cyber within exercises. And as you migrate from an initial planning conference to a mid-planning conference to a final planning conference, the training objectives that you hoped or aspired to integrating within the scenario are kind of dismissed, if you will, because they distract from the larger training objectives. I believe there's a lot of missed opportunities still when it comes to educating others on how important cyberspace operations is, not only as a supporting role, but as a supported role.
What would you see then as your ultimate scenario then? Not a training scenario, but based on the description you just had, and I'm trying to get now into a little bit of that discussion of the innovation enterprise that you're very dedicated to. You walk in as NCDOT commander and you're given a blank check. What do you see as cyber's involvement in these kind of fleet preparation exercises? What are the challenges that you would knock down?
Well, we've been spending a lot of time on that of late. How do you integrate training objectives into COM2X, into JTFX? We've been developing in partnership with folks across the waterfront here in Norfolk, scenarios that would be more realistic to what they might expect on a deployment. The biggest challenge in all of that is not the fact, well, they are very receptive to that, and they want us to really test things out for them and stretch their team before they deploy. But the biggest challenge has been at the individual level is to the lack, in my opinion, of individual level training when it comes to defensive cyberspace operations. That it is one thing to augment a strike group with some just-in-time expertise. It is another one to have that integrated expertise across the IT rating within the ship's company. So as I work with ship COs and we try to partner with surface forces to develop team trainers and put in some requirements within the Surface Forces Readiness Manual. The challenge is that at the individual level, because there's lack of a schoolhouse training solution at this point, their ability to plug into the optimal group sale or team trainer scenario that would really flex them so they were equipped to succeed on deployment.
So those are some of the external challenges, getting an organization that's very physical space operations oriented to sort of integrate an understanding and appreciation and preparation for the sort of metaphysical world that they all sort of operate upon. What are some of the internal challenges to those who haven't read it yet? It's a very interesting article, War on the Rocks, discussing the Intel community wants disruptive change without being disrupted. And before we started the podcast, I asked you if you'd read it and you had some thoughts, and I asked you to stop because I didn't want to use the juice before we got into the podcast proper. So with that article keyed up in a way that does not require the audience necessary to have read it, your thoughts?
Well, I'll tell you, I got excited when I read the title of the article, and then I read the article. And I thought both were extremely relevant topics, but the title did not capture the article. I do believe that we, and I'm not just focusing on the intelligence community, but I would include it, that we do want disruptive change. And I do believe that at the most senior levels, given my last job, I worked directly for Admiral Rogers as his executive assistant at U.S. Cyber Command and the National Security Agency, that there is an invitation for disruptive change. The challenge is at what I've heard you and others refer to as the frozen middle, the ability for those of us who aren't at the top to really feel right about questioning the status quo and meeting the needs of a continually evolving world in which we live. I wrestle with it at work at the small, relatively small, 530 person command that I get to be a part of each and every day. And we are so indoctrinated in the way that we've always thought that it really takes a long time for people to feel comfortable that the senior leaders are in fact serious when they say we need disruptive change. So what I look at the junior officers of today, and I see how passionate they are and how willing they are to question everything and provide some real exciting solutions. And then I see at the senior level how ready they are to say yes to some of these things that they never even get the attention. They never get the opportunity to say yes to. So when I read the article, I thought that it was in fact a true statement, especially at the end when it quoted an operational commander who is by and large the customer of intelligence, stating that it did not meet his needs. It was not enabling him to make decisions. And that's what it's all about. In the intelligence community or Navy Cyber Defense Operations Command, we don't exist for ourselves. We exist for the customer. And the customer has a vote, has a most significant vote, and we better be responding to them.
And speaking of the customer, you know, there's another group that happens to have a vote, and that's the adversary. Now, we have seen kind of an evolution of, I'll say cyber war again, something else I'll put in quotes and let you know because you can't see it, because we've barely come to a point where we've even defined what a cyber war is. But it's one of those things, we know it when we see it. And you've seen the Georgia and Estonia attacks with someone bringing down the internet itself, so the cyber domain is sort of disrupted. You've seen physical attacks like what was done to the Iranian centrifuges with Stuxnet, and now you're seeing sort of further use of this technology. That's even another dumb term, this technology. It's so broad, it's different every time, of what's called the black energy malware in Ukraine. So we've discussed a little bit about what we're doing about defending our networks, about the systems we put in place, the institutions, the kinds of people. But what direction do you see this concept, cyber war, going? What's something that, and I hate to use this cliche, but it works, keeps you as a cyber operator up at night? Because I think, to a certain point, you have a far greater appreciation of our weaknesses and the potentials than a lot of folks in the operational world do. But you can also appreciate, perhaps, that live free or die hard hyperbole, or we think some cyber dude's going to go in and hack Sor's battleship and make it explode. You know, something that they would say on CNN that makes no sense.
Right. So I can tell you that we are reminded on a daily basis of how vulnerable we are. We can acknowledge the fact that we do a lot of silly things that make us more vulnerable than we need to be. So we have a long way to go culturally. We know what the adversary, or we believe we know what the adversaries could potentially do to us if they really wanted to. And like I said earlier, it goes back to accepting risk. We throw the term around a lot in our world, which is that of cyber key terrain, identifying what it is we truly have to defend and protect. We can't defend everything. We can't protect everything. So we have to be committed to, you know, our priorities. What is the cyber terrain that we must maintain access to and defend our adversaries from? I think that the biggest thing that concerns me, and I know I'm far from alone in this, you can read about it on any day, is the depth of our knowledge across our team. We have a very capable team at NCDOC. We have a very, very capable team at U.S. Cyber Command, at Fleet Cyber Command, at anybody or any organization that operates within this domain. The challenge is that we're not as deep as we need to be, and I don't know that we're making the investments that will enable us to be even more relevant or have a deeper bench in the future. You know, I'm reminded, I won't say on a daily basis, on a weekly basis, about retention of some amazing young men and women who go out to the private sector and are still involved in this mission area, but from a very different vantage point. So I get concerned about our ability to continually train these individuals, give them reason to stay on our team. And then I think equally important is our ability to truly partner with some non-traditional teammates that are not necessarily within the Navy or within the DOD. So those industry, those academia partnerships that might not be, or actually are not as strong as they need to be.
You know, I'm actually reminded of my first command where I was introduced to the concept you mentioned specifically on the retention side, just because our EMO, electronic maintenance officer, was trying to get the Navy to retain one of our IIT1s who coincidentally was being recruited by Google at the same time. You know, whatever the exam may say or whatever the fit reps may say, when Google comes to get your guy, that's when you say, all right, my system's cute and all, but Google is here trying to recruit my guy, and we didn't. You know, the institution said, this is my system, this is how I'm going to judge this guy, and he doesn't meet the artificial wickets that I've created, and we lost a really good operator. But as the sort of cherry to the top of this Cyber Sunday, if you will, you were also the executive assistant to the director of the NSA, which is really kind of, I would argue, and I'm sure you would agree, a special and unique opportunity based on what that institution is capable of, what it's responsible for, and the kinds of people that pay attention to what it's doing on a daily, very intimate basis. What was that like, being EA to Admiral Rogers?
Well, I would have to say that it's one of the most amazing experiences that I've had in my naval career. As I stated earlier, my life has been a bunch of plan Bs, and having that opportunity was not a plan B, a C. I didn't even know it existed. And when I got the opportunity, I was intimidated. It's a big job, and he's a wonderful leader, a very demanding leader. And quite honestly, it was not playing to my strengths. As I laugh about now, attention to detail has never been my strong suit. and that bit me in the butt more than a few times. But just the opportunity to sit in the room and have conversations with and witness conversations he had with others as he would put it, simultaneously tried to change a culture at NSA and create a culture at U.S. Cyber Command. And watching him navigate those two very different roles while wearing one hat. It was very educational for me, personally, professionally, and I learned a lot from the operational standpoint. And, you know, I think it was maybe 3 weeks ago when I last exchanged a conversation with him that I did not realize that I had learned as much until I've been in this job. Because I find myself applying and reaching back to some of the things I didn't even know I learned during our 13 months together. So it was absolutely amazing.
I mean, absolutely. To a certain point, I wonder how many people realize that the NSA is even run by the military. You know, they hear DIA is civilian. That's pretty credible. And I think Admiral Rogers is the first four-star to head up the NSA. Is that correct?
Well, General Alexander got his four-star as U.S. Cyber Command. So it's important to point out that the director of NSA job is a three-star job. The commander of U.S. Cyber Command is a four-star job. So that transition happened while General Alexander was leading. So yes, Admiral Rogers is the first one to come into the job as a four-star.
That's really interesting. I would have never have thought of that. Is that Cybercom would be more highly ranked than the NSA? It's almost you'd think it'd be the reverse. I don't know.
Well, it's all about the peer group. So look at all the other COCOMs; they're all 4 stars, I believe. And then the other heads of intel agencies are not. They're 3. If they are military. But at first, I think that it is important to point out for Emma Rogers is that he was the first career SIGINT professional to head the NSA.
Right.
The others have been intel professionals, not SIGINT.
There we go. I think we've come up on our 30-minute mark here, and as this is being put in here at the last minute on a Sunday, you know, calling an audible, I definitely don't want to take any more time from your family, as I do recall and respect that list of priorities that you gave me at the beginning of the podcast. So I'm sure that they're nattering about somewhere looking for daddy's attention. I'm surprised that my son has not started screaming for either more milk or that he has turned the milk into poop somewhere. But before we go, you know, we went over such a broad stroke of topics. Is there anything you want to close out with? And of course, this is open. This could be books people should read. This should be reflections from your career. This could be a topic that I didn't ask a question on and that you've been sort of itching to give an answer about, whatever the case may be. So this is open forum, whatever you want to talk about that you think is important to leave our listeners with.
Okay. Well, one of the things that have been weighing heavy on my mind based on my personal experiences in the job that I have right now is that of short-term thinking. As a commanding officer, it's quite a privilege, and you show up to a job and you know that it's for a finite period of time. Any job in the military is for a finite period of time. For me, it's a 2-year job. I've been in the job for 165 days. And this whole sense of urgency to get things done during my watch, if you will, pulls me in one direction. At the same time, I'm very quick to realize that my real job is to write a chapter in a book that covers the overarching command for 2 years of what has been a 10-year journey so far. In fact, this Friday, we're hosting our 10-year anniversary at NCDOC, where we're going to invite back the first CO of NCDOC, as well as some distinguished civilian alums who've gone on to do great things in industry. We just wish we could have some of them back on a more full-time basis. But it's that constant tension between the short-term thinking and the need for us to prepare for the future. And I wonder what or how much time we as leaders spend preparing the teams that we are leading for life after we are gone. And I'm not getting morbid about death or anything. Surely that is inevitable as well. But all too often, we define success as what happens on our watch, what we are able to accomplish on our watch. And we at NCDOC have been spending a lot of time of late preparing for the future, thinking about the future, questioning how we do everything today and making sure that it is more reflective of a 21st century culture, and that in defense of cyberspace operations, it's a constantly evolving mission area. And if we are successful today, does not mean we're successful tomorrow. So we put some things in place that will give us more time, carve out more time to redefine how we do things and then rethink about what it is we should be doing 5-10 years from now. So I just ask that the audience give some thought to not only the day-to-day, how you define success day-to-day, but what is your role as a strategic leader within your organization?
And speaking of which, Some of you may be aware that SimSec elections are coming up in a few months, and I've already reached out to a few folks. So, not only in the operational realm in the military, and of course the cyber defense enterprise that Captain Heritage is talking about, but success for institutions over time, consider for yourself how you might get involved in SimSec. We're always looking for new editors, new writers. If you got an idea for a podcast or you'd like to put yourself into the hat for an elected position, start considering those now, because you know what, it doesn't just apply to the military or our professional careers, but when you're trying to build an organization like this one, some people do go on to department head school and baby care and have to turn this place over to somebody. But Captain Heritage, it has been great to have you here, all of our listeners. Give us 5 stars. Give us a rating. Listen, by the way, everyone, to the Real Time Strategy podcast. I am slowly turning that project over to our awesome membership secretary, Brett Perry. So that's a really good product where we discuss simulations from the tabletop to your computer screen, what you can and cannot learn from them. But for now, this was Sea Control, and sir, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on.
Matthew, thank you for the opportunity, and thanks for all else you do to inspire so many creative thinking, so much creative thought across the Navy and beyond.
I certainly hope I'm not the first line of defense there, because then we're all in trouble. Anyway, sir, thanks. I'll talk to you later.
All right. Out here.